Is it not true that if God only blesses Americans, then Americans will spend the rest of their lives fighting those who God hasn't blessed?
Despite all the frantic efforts of the administration, they have not been able to establish a link between Saddam Hussein and September 11th. It's as simple as that. They haven't.
There's only three words that can describe what we saw. Oh, my God. Within 72 hours of us getting up there, we all started getting sick.
I and other inspectors are focused on disarming Iraq. You know, our methodologies are justifiable. You can't blame us for trying to overcome Iraqi lies and obstruction.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, December 24th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Iraq's chief representative to the UN mission says Iraq is prepared to talk to top UN inspectors about their criticism of Baghdad's 12,000-page arms declaration, but it has nothing new to add. In an exclusive interview, General Hassan Mohammed Amin said he saw nothing to justify the criticisms expressed last week by Chief UN Inspector Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradi, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Meanwhile, teams of UN and IAEA inspectors visited nine sites today looking for weapons of mass destruction. Among the sites was the Hattin Company, a complex of factories 45 miles south of Baghdad that produces artillery ammunition, among other things. Last week, Blix and El-Baradi said the declaration that Iraq presented earlier this month was largely a rehash of old information and they would be seeking more data from Iraq. Scott Ritter is a former UN weapons inspector who quit his position after inspectors left the country in 1991. Armando Gadinha of Pacifica Station KPFK asked Ritter about the inspector's mission then and now.
I recall years ago when I used to see you sometimes in some really strong verbal confrontations with representatives of the Iraqi government, whether it was upon entering or attempting to enter a location. What was the process 10 years ago, and what do you speculate is the process now? What has been the difference in and how, if any at all, has it been set up to fail?
Well, in order for inspections to work, the Iraqis have to be fully compliant and cooperative. When you witnessed on TV a scene, whether it was myself or another inspector verbally challenging the Iraqis to let us in, what you were seeing is a failure of the process. The Iraqis aren't allowed to shut the door, aren't allowed to keep the door barred, aren't allowed to block the weapons inspections. But the fact is, I also mentioned many times that the, when you pass a law, you have to, for the law to have any value, you have to enforce the law. You know, the law said Iraq must fully cooperate. When the Iraqis block the inspectors and I'm reduced to the point of yelling at them to no avail, and the Security Council doesn't back me or anybody else up, then the law is useless. The law has failed. We spent, when I was a weapons inspector, 60% of our effort was spent overcoming Iraqi concealment, obstruction, lies, and deceit. That doesn't make for a very effective inspection regime. The inspectors today are empowered in a way that we never were. They have a resolution now that has gone on record as saying that this law will be enforced, that the Iraqis must fully cooperate. This means that when the inspectors appear before a facility, the gates must instantly open. This means the inspectors can, spend 100% of their effort on the technical and scientific duties of weapons inspections. The inspections today are much more efficient, much more effective than the inspections were that I led. They don't have to deal with overcoming obstruction and obstacles and deceit. So on the one hand, the inspections are programmed to succeed in a way that that the inspections I participated in never were. However, understand that there's something that that unites these two events, and that is the United States government's policy of regime removal. It is a corrupting influence. It basically pollutes the integrity of the process of the investigation. It's one of the reasons why the inspection regime that I worked in for 7 years failed, that we were no longer seen as fair and objective implementers of international mandate. We became nothing more than tools facilitating American unilateral policy objective of removing Saddam Hussein. So while we might have inspectors in Iraq today who are getting the cooperation of the Iraqi government, who are doing the job of disarmament in a much more focused manner, as long as the United States continues to adhere to a policy of regime removal, understand that the United States will only view the inspections as useful insofar as they facilitate eliminating Saddam Hussein. Ultimately, the United States will corrupt the integrity of this process of investigation, and for that reason, I believe that this process is doomed to fail so long as America adheres to a policy of regime removal.
Some critics have indicated that when you led the inspections 10 years ago, you were part of the effort to corrupt that process and in an effort to justify additional movements against the Iraqi regime. What do you say to those critics?
No, I mean, again, the cause and effect relationship is Iraq was compelled to cooperate. They weren't. It's not my fault that Iraq chose to lie. It's not my fault that Iraq chose to conceal. I'm a weapons inspector. My job is to disarm Iraq, and that was the job of hundreds of other inspectors. That meant that we had to overcome Iraqi obstruction, overcome concealment. We had to embrace the tools and methodologies of intelligence in order to gain access to the information we needed to do to accomplish our mission. Iraq forced us to undertake the missions that we did. Iraq is the corrupting influence. Now, as long, though, as I and other inspectors are focused on disarming Iraq, our methodologies are justifiable. You can't blame us for trying to overcome Iraqi lies and obstruction. The problem comes when somebody uses the unique access we enjoyed for purposes other than disarmament. It wasn't me or the other inspectors who were the corrupting influence. It was the United States of America who used the process of the investigation to gain access to information that had nothing to do whatsoever with disarming Iraq and everything to do with eliminating Saddam Hussein. So I blame two parties. I blame Iraq for getting us in the situation where I had to undertake, espionage-type activities to do my job. And I blame the United States for failing to respect the integrity of the investigation and using information which we gained access to, which had nothing to do with disarmament and everything to do with Saddam Hussein's security, and use this information to empower them in implementation of their unilateral policy objective of regime removal, which was not mandated by the Security Council.
Former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter speaking with KPFK programmer Armando Gardinia. Since the 1991 Gulf War, more than 80,000 Iraqis have fled their country illegally by climbing across the mountainous Kurdish region and into Turkey with the help of a smuggler. These refugees dream of reaching America someday, where they hope they can get a better life. But as Aaron Glantz reports from the Turkish capital, Ankara, the refugees are finding a closed door from the Turkish and American governments.
There's tea boiling on the stove at the Protestant International Church in the Turkish capital, Ankara. It's a small church behind a shopping center where refugee families come for food aid and legal advice. Refugees like Habib, who sits in the church's kitchen with three of his children. He's a former chef for the United Nations Oil for Food Program in northern Iraq. He says he was repeatedly tortured by Saddam Hussein's elite forces, who threw him in a tank of ice up to his chest for 3 days.
He put for me in a small room, and in this room will be water. After 1 hour, it will be ice. 3 days I am in this ice. After that, you hate me too much, and you take my wife also ahead, and you're breaking the hands for my son. I show you. You see?
Habib points to his youngest son, Hamid's elbow. It's permanently disfigured. It doesn't bend like an elbow should. It just hangs limp, unusable. Habib said it was the torture of his son that caused him to pay a smuggler $7,000 to traffic his family illegally across the Iraqi border and into Turkey. Habib dreams of bringing his family to America. But for 2 years, the American government and the United Nations has stalled in his case. In the meantime, like 80,000 other illegal Iraqi refugees in Turkey, he is forbidden from working. His children are not allowed to go to school.
It's my children is in a half furniture because no school, no nothing.
No school?
No school. Now, 1 year, 7 ago, no school. So I would teach him every time in my house.
And this is because they're not allowed in school?
Yeah. So what can I tell you? I'm waiting. Only maybe the God helped me with Jesus. This is the last for me, I thought. You know, because I now have a job. Only the church helped me pay the rent and give me some money from the food.
Have you looked for a job?
No. Here?
Yeah, in Turkey.
No.
And this is why?
When I go, he told me, you're Iraqi, you're Yabanchi. No, I know it's like this.
Here in Turkey, there is no work, you know. We have no... the law in Turkish government doesn't allow to the refugee people to work. We live here a hard time.
Adil is another Iraqi refugee living in Ankara. The former Iraqi fighter pilot came to Turkey a year and a half ago. He too dreams of coming to the U.S., but for a year and a half, he's been stuck in a bureaucratic morass of the United Nations Refugee Program and the American Immigration Authorities.
And I went to the United Nations, and I made an interview. After 1 year, I was rejected by United Nations, and I gave my appeal. They gave me another rejection, and after that, I gave my appeal. They sent for me to make an interview. After an interview, they said to me, wait. Until now, I am waiting for their reply.
While Adil waits for an answer from the International Immigration Authorities, he survives on occasional illegal work scrubbing floors in restaurants. Wendy Bilgin runs the refugee program at the International Protestant Church.
So for them, a lot of times we ask them, what would happen if you went back? And because that's the only alternative we can think of for them.
In the meantime, Habib's eldest son, Hani, waits and watches TV. I can't go to school, he says, so I watch 3 or 4 hours of TV a day. Hani says he hopes to learn Turkish by watching movies with Jackie Chan and Jean-Claude Van Damme. He says he has no friends in Turkey. He wants to come to America. For Pacificus Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in the Turkish capital, Ankara.
Baghdad, dancers of death, murder in the air with the next breath. Macho queens selling war makers' toys, raining destruction, good old boys. Deathbringer in Queen George's eyes, read his lips, war maker lies. Religious Reich's revenging sword. Thou shalt kill in the name of the Lord. The sheep and the cattle can't keep from milling. Some are more than ready, some aren't willing. Volunteering in what they're not dying for. The young Republican Guard crying for war. Free speech, as free as it's thought. Controlled behavior reacts as it's taught. Fighting for peace, can't comprehend. Hate out of love is violent pretend.
John Trudell's Bombs Over Baghdad. As the U.S. government prepares to send tens of thousands of troops into war in Iraq, the fight continues for justice and fair compensation for the veterans suffering from their service in the last Gulf War. In the second of a two-part series, Peace Watch correspondent Melinda Tuhus examines the price Gulf War vets are paying and what the future holds.
Major Doug Rocky is an expert on the impacts of depleted uranium on the human body. Not only is he an Army health physicist who headed the Pentagon's depleted uranium project in the Gulf region after the war, he's also a victim of the toxic and radioactive substance, which has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. Rocky and his team went to Saudi Arabia shortly after the war ended, charged with cleaning up the mess left by 350 tons of contaminated uranium-238 in abandoned tanks and other military detritus. They didn't know what to expect.
There's only three words that can describe what we saw. Oh, my God. Within 72 hours of us getting up there, we all started getting sick. We started developing respiratory problems. We started developing the rashes, and the rashes to this day are still open. And the rash, what it does is an open sore that breaks open and bleeds, and then it heals, and then it breaks open and bleeds at another point. The friendly fire casualties were having the medical problems all over the place. And the Iraqis, the children, everybody was having the problems. And it got transferred back to the medical staff.
The Pentagon considers depleted uranium, or DU, an important element in its arsenal. The American military has used it in tank armor and in tank-piercing munitions in the Gulf War and in many other conflicts around the world. Rocky says in March 1991, he received a memo reminding him of the battlefield importance of DU.
Quote, there is a relatively small amount of lethality data for uranium penetrators. The recent war has likely multiplied the number of DU rounds fired at targets by orders of magnitude. It is believed that DU penetrators were very effective against Iraqi armor. There has been and continues to be a concern regarding the impact of DU in the environment. Therefore, if no one makes a case for the effectiveness of DU on the battlefield, DU rounds may become politically unacceptable and thus be deleted from the arsenal. If DU penetrators prove their worth during our recent combat activities, then we should assure their future existence. I believe should keep this sensitive issue in mind whenever action reports are written. My written directive, ladies and gentlemen, to lie about what we saw and what we heard.
Rocky quotes from official documents to reveal contradictions in orders first to provide medical care for all DU casualties, then orders saying treatment was not necessary. He exemplifies the problems vets had getting answers and treatment for DU exposure.
They never provided me the testing required. And then November of 1994, when I conducted tests as the director of the project at the Nevada test site, the U.S. Department of Energy finally did a radio bioassay on myself. They got the results back at the end of February, beginning of March of 1995, and never told me for 2.5 years that my uranium excretion was 432 micrograms per liter. That's 5,000 times the permissible level.
Rocky suffers from cataracts, rashes, and kidney and respiratory problems. The Veterans Administration has awarded him 40% disability. Rocky is convinced that exposure to depleted uranium has contributed to, if not caused, his medical problems and those of thousands of other vets. But no one knows for sure because the problem has been very little studied.
If you don't provide the testing, you don't find the contamination. If you don't find the contamination, any health effects they have can't be related.
Dan Fahey is trying to change that. Fahey, a Gulf War veteran, is an expert on depleted uranium who served on the board of the National Gulf War Resource Center. He likens the way the Department of Defense and the Veterans Administration ignored and downplayed Vietnam vets' exposure to the carcinogen dioxin in Agent Orange to how the military has downplayed all the toxic exposures that veterans encountered in the Gulf War. Fahey notes that so far, the Pentagon has limited its study of DU exposure to just 3 or 4 dozen vets.
In 1998, through documents that we obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, myself and others working on the DU issue forced the Pentagon to admit that, in fact, far larger numbers than 35 had been exposed. And at that time, the Pentagon spokesman said, well, thousands of soldiers may have been exposed to depleted uranium. But they never quantified that further. And, you know, whether that meant 2,000 or whether that meant 200,000, you know, we were left to guess that.
Fahey describes what medical researchers have discovered about DU in the body.
Among the reported findings that have been published, we know that they have found depleted uranium in veteran semen, that there have been slight neurological problems that they've identified among the veterans, and also that some veterans who retain depleted uranium fragments because they were wounded by depleted uranium when their vehicles were hit, that those veterans continue to excrete high levels of uranium in their urine because those fragments are breaking down and entering the bloodstream, and in addition to depositing in various organs, the uranium is leaving the body in the urine.
Fahey says he found a footnote in a Pentagon report mentioning a cancer that occurred in one vet among the small number being followed. But, he said, a Pentagon official later assured nervous Europeans that no cancers had been found among American vets, and therefore there was nothing to worry about from DU exposure.
But the fact remains that they had found a case of cancer among 51 vets that they looked at, and then you had the Pentagon publicly lying about the existence of the cancer. So it's really left me scratching my head and wondering, you know, is this the only case of cancer they've seen among the small number of veterans that they've examined? And can we trust that the VA and the Pentagon are truthfully reporting about the health of veterans that they have examined who were exposed to depleted uranium?
Veterans groups are calling for the kind of in-depth, large-scale study of those exposed to depleted uranium that was finally done to look at Vietnam vets' exposure to dioxin and that resulted in thousands of vets winning disability compensation. But Fahey says he's seen Pentagon documents that imply a long struggle ahead for Gulf War vets.
We have, you know, documents where they've put it in writing that they're concerned about the financial implications of disability, you know, payments for Gulf War illness and specifically for depleted uranium.
He reads an excerpt.
When DU is indicted as a causative agent for Desert Storm illness, the Army must have sufficient data to separate fiction from reality. Without forethought and data, the financial implications of long-term disability payments and health care costs would be excessive.
No one from the Deployment Health Support Directorate, the Pentagon department that oversees the health of U.S. troops, would respond to the criticisms raised here by veterans groups, depleted uranium experts, and health professionals. Since DU is still considered a valuable component in the U.S. military arsenal, its continued use can be expected to create more human subjects for research in the next war. This is Melinda Tuhus reporting.
Troops headed for the Middle East to fight a possible war against Iraq are being inoculated with a vaccine for smallpox. But a growing number of healthcare workers and physicians have taken a stance against administering and taking the recommended vaccine for the smallpox virus as being suggested by the Bush administration. A number of workers have signed a pledge of resistance. So far, two major hospitals have refused to comply with administering the vaccines, and Jeffrey Copeland, former director of the Centers for Disease Control, has spoken against it. The hope is that if enough refuse to administer the vaccine, it will derail what they see as a scare tactic on the part of the administration to launch war against the people of Iraq. Dr. Halil Cohen, assistant professor of epidemiology and social medicine at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, has calculated the risk and decided to take the pledge, and he's urging others to sign on.
Smallpox vaccination and vaccine is not warranted at this time. There is no smallpox out there in the world. There's not been a single case of smallpox for over 20 years in the entire world, not in the United States for more than 30 years, in the whole world for over 20 years. And there's no evidence of risk. The only thing that we've been told is that somebody somewhere may have it, and we're being asked by the Bush administration and those in so-called intelligence agencies to trust them that there is this danger. In my opinion, I think it's a hype that has been manufactured to promote a pro-war agenda and has nothing to do with public health.
So your opposition goes beyond just opposing it. You and other healthcare workers are taking a pledge to actually do what?
There are healthcare workers who are signing on to a pledge neither to get the vaccine nor to give it. The smallpox vaccine has a higher risk of side effects than any other vaccine. Certainly for many decades, for centuries, when smallpox was endemic in the world, when it was a natural disease, a disease that existed, the smallpox vaccination was warranted, was justified, because even with these side effects, if there was an actual danger of getting the disease, it was worthwhile. But there has not been that danger for many years. The World Health Organization recommended an end to vaccinations over 20 years ago, and really nothing has changed. The only thing that has changed has been this super overheated hype of a risk that for which there's no evidence.
Are there any risks associated with actually taking the vaccine?
Yes. A large number, perhaps as many as a third of the people who take it may get some mild reactions, swelling, infection, rash, joint pain. Many may get a flu-like illness that may take them to bed or keep them at home from work for a day or a couple of days. There is also a possibility of more serious illness, though these are rare, and some estimates based on the historic experience have been 50 to 900 cases per million, and perhaps life-threatening as many as 15 to 50 cases per million, and in every million people who take it, anywhere from 1 to 3 deaths. This is based on normal people taking it, you know, people who don't have immune suppression. And when those of us who are over 30 years old who got the vaccine back then, there was a much lower level of immune suppression. We didn't have HIV/AIDS at the time. There were no cancer patients with immune-suppressing drugs. The number of people with lupus may have been the same, but we weren't as aware of it. People with eczema are also at high risk of bad side effects. As many as 50 million people in the United States alone are being recommended not to take the vaccine because of these conditions. Certainly anybody who is even thinking of it, are they even aware that they may have it? The other concern is that in addition to the person getting the inoculation, this is a live virus vaccine. It's not smallpox virus, it's cowpox virus. But it is a live virus vaccine, which means that after the inoculation, the person inoculated can shed virus, meaning they can share the inoculation, so to speak, with people they come in close contact with.
But weren't these same risks and concerns and conditions an issue when smallpox vaccines were issued years ago?
Yes, and again, it's the balance. If the disease is prevalent in the world, if it's going around, if it's out there,
then it makes sense.
Then
to
it
have.
Makes sense.
Now,
all vaccine theory is based on this balance of risk of exposure versus risk of side effects.
Clearly, the Bush administration feels as though the individuals that they are asking or requiring to take this smallpox vaccine may be in harm's way, if in fact they are stationed in Iraq and are exposed to smallpox.
There's no evidence that smallpox is outside of the United States or in Russia, which are the official depositories. There's been a rumor that France acknowledged they may have had some, but the likelihood that there's weaponized smallpox out there is so tiny. Certainly in a country like Iraq. Now, everyone knows that Iraq is not vaccinating its population. So if they had such a plan, which I don't think they do, if they had the capability, which I don't think they do, they would inoculate their people. To release smallpox when you don't have your own inoculation would be risking your own people.
Suicidal?
Well, yeah, I'd call it that, except that the notion that smallpox, yes, it's a deadly disease, and the fatality rate is relatively high for such a thing, and anywhere from 15% to 20 to 25%. We don't know because it's hasn't been around for so long. But the ability for it to spread is not like it has been rumored in the media. It requires close physical contact.
Well, I'm sure there are those who would argue that even though the jury is still out on this, according to many experts, that Saddam Hussein has released poisonous gas on his own people in the past, and therefore there exists a possibility, albeit perhaps a tiny one, that he might actually, if backed into a corner, release smallpox.
Well, you're building assumptions after assumptions, and one could manufacture any sort of scenarios. I mean, from my perspective, one way to avoid that risk is keep the U.S. soldiers out of Iraq. But I don't think that's the issue. I think it's the other way around, that in order to justify going into Iraq to take the oil, for example, How do you justify it? Just saying, well, we're going to steal their oil, that doesn't sound so good. So if you say, well, we're going to defend against these weapons of mass destruction, we're going to defend against smallpox, well, then you have to convince the people that they have it. Well, this is a way, I think, that the administration is trying to convince people that their war effort is justified. See, we think they have it, so we're vaccinating all of you. It's a way of asking the public to roll up its sleeves in support of its war effort.
Dr. Hillel Cohen is Assistant Professor of Epidemiology and Social Medicine at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. For more information, contact their website at www.healthworker.org. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.